from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, international concern about the rising tensions in Ukraine. Israeli-U.S. discussions held at the White House on Mideast peace. Pistoria's trial judge notes pitfalls of media attention. And desertification is being tied to climate change and security.
Not many people know that 80% of the major armed conflict that affected society occurred in vulnerable dryland ecosystems.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Russian President Vladimir Putin has described the political power shift in Ukraine as a coup and seemed to deny Russian forces have moved into Ukrainian territory, including Crimea. But he said that they potentially could. Speaking to reporters at the presidential residence outside Moscow, Mr. Putin called the ouster of Viktor Yanukovych as Ukraine's president an anti-constitutional coup, an armed seizure of power, and said neo-Nazis, nationalists, and anti-Semites were running rampant in parts of Ukraine, including the capital, Kiev. He said Mr. Yanukovych, who fled to Russia, remains Ukraine's legitimate leader. On Saturday, Russia's parliament granted Mr. Putin the authority to use military force to protect Russian citizens and soldiers throughout Ukraine. Mr. Putin today appeared to deny that any Russian troops have invaded Ukrainian territory. Ukrainian officials say Moscow has sent 16,000 troops into Crimea since last week. The Russian president said the armed men in uniforms without insignia who had blockaded Ukrainian forces on the peninsula were local self-defense forces, not Russian soldiers. He said those forces had not been trained by Russia. Mr. Putin also said Russia has no plans to annex Crimea. Asked under what conditions he might send troops into Ukraine, Mr. Putin said, for the time being, this is not necessary. Russian military forces might be sent into Ukraine only as a last resort, he said. While Russia says China supports its actions in Ukraine, the Chinese government's comments on the crisis have been muted. Shannon Van Sant reports from Beijing.
As the crisis in Ukraine unfolds with Russian military troops fanning out around Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, Russian diplomats have asserted that China supports Russia's actions there. Throughout this week, China's comments on the situation have been muted. Qinggang, China's foreign ministry spokesperson, said China believes in non-interference in internal affairs and is taking into consideration historical facts as well as the complexity of the situation. That statement contrasts one earlier this week from Russia's foreign ministry after the Russian and Chinese foreign ministers spoke by telephone. Russia said Moscow and Beijing had broadly coinciding views on the situation in Ukraine, implying that Russia had China's support for its military actions in the country. China's foreign ministry, however, has said China respects the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine and that all parties should use dialogue and negotiation to preserve peace in the region. Chinese news media coverage has been more pointed. In an editorial this week, China's Global Times newspaper stated that the Ukrainian situation shows us clearly that in the international political arena, principles are decided by power. In a commentary, China's Xinhua news agency argued that the West's biased mediation has polarized Ukraine and only made things worse in the country. Wang Dong, a professor of international relations at Peking University, says conflicting views represented by the Chinese media and government are because China has much to lose and gain with the unfolding crisis in Ukraine.
China also has a lot of stake involved because we have, business. With Ukraine.
In recent years, Ukraine and China have formed military, trade, and agricultural partnerships. In 2012, Ukraine became the fourth largest arms exporter in the world, with many of those exports going to China. China's first aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, was built in Ukraine. Ukraine agreed last year to a deal for China to lease 5% of the country's land to grow crops and raise pigs for sale to Chinese state-owned companies. As part of that deal, China promised to build highways and bridges in the country. China also pledged $8 billion in aid during ousted Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych's visit to Beijing in December. That was in addition to $10 billion China had previously given to the country. War in Ukraine would endanger China's investments there, and China's comments this week may be a delicate balance between offering some support for its neighbor Russia without directly backing military intervention from any side that could throw the region into more chaos. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations has strongly condemned Russia, saying there is nothing to justify its military presence in neighboring Ukraine. Samantha Powers spoke at an emergency session of the U.N. Security Council on Monday.
The solution to this crisis is not difficult to envision. There is a way out, and that is through direct and immediate dialogue by Russia with the government of Ukraine, the immediate pullback of Russia's military forces, the restoration of Ukraine's territorial integrity, and the urgent deployment of observers and human rights monitors, not through more threats and more distortions.
The U.S. ambassador also called Russia's intervention an act of aggression and not the humanitarian mission that Moscow is seeking to portray. Russian Ambassador Vitaly Churkin read a statement from Ukraine's ousted pro-Russian president Viktor Yanukovych in which he asked Moscow to intervene militarily. The statement said the intervention was needed to restore peace and stability to Ukraine. In London Monday, Prime Minister David Cameron warned Russia about its actions in Ukraine.
I've been chairing a meeting of the National Security Council because the situation in the Ukraine is of deep concern. Concern to everyone in our country because we all want to see stability and countries obeying the rule of law. What matters now is a very clear message is sent from across the world to the people of the Ukraine that we want to allow you to choose your own future, and an equally clear message to the Russian government that continuing down this path of violating the sovereignty of another country will have costs and consequences. The whole world needs to come together to deliver that message. It's important the UN is at the forefront of that message, which is why I spoke to Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and we also need to do everything we can to get the Russian and Ukrainian governments to talk to each other about their future.
The British leader also said he wants to see a de-escalation of the crisis in the Crimean Peninsula. Some analysts contend that Russia is eager to send troops to Crimea because he wants to secure its Black Sea naval operation, which is based in Sevastopol. University of New Haven national security professor and former military operations instructor for the U.S. Army, Matthew Schmidt, disagrees. He tells VOA that Russia has no interest in the naval operation because the base is highly outdated and the lease on it is near expiration.
This is about the fact that Ukraine has long been thought of as part of Russia. In fact, you can see this in the way commentators in the news report on this. They tend to say the Ukraine. And in Russian and in Ukrainian, what that means is the frontier. There's a meaning to the word Ukraine, and it's not the state, it's the frontier. And so when you say the Ukraine, what you're saying to a Slavic speaker is this place that is part of Russia that is its western frontier. And it is not denoting it as an independent state. So it should be spoken of as Ukraine with no definite article. And to me, that is the crux of what's going on. Kiev, if you go back to, I'll get this date somewhat wrong, I think 988, is the heart of the Russian Empire. It was called the Kievan Rus at the time, and that is the point that Slavs mark as the development of the Christian Russian Empire. And so Kiev is considered to be a sacred place in the Orthodox Empire, in the Orthodox world. And at that point, right, there's no differentiation between a Ukrainian or a Russian. That comes later in history. And so for many, that differentiation is weak or doesn't exist even today, right? The other thing is that people often make a big deal about the linguistic differences between Western Ukraine and Eastern Ukraine, as though everyone west of Kiev speaks Ukrainian and not Russian, and east of Kiev, Russian and not Ukrainian, when in fact, the majority of the population throughout Ukraine speaks both Ukrainian and Russian. The languages are almost fully mutually communicable with each other. There are key words and historical differences in some lettering and things like that, but a Russian speaker can easily understand Ukrainian and vice versa. And so the ethnic divisions and linguistic divisions are not as strong as they are often portrayed. Even in Crimea, which has a majority ethnic Russian and ethnic a population that is majority ethnic Russian and for whom Russian is their primary language, their first language, it's only a 60% majority. Roughly the other 40% of the population in Crimea are ethnic Tartars, which are a Turkic people from the time of the Mongol takeover of that area, or ethnic Ukrainians. So even if a 100% of all 60% of ethnic Russians in Crimea were to support a Russian takeover of Crimea, it would be a weak and essentially illegitimate vote for a Russian takeover. And given the fact that not even all of the 60% are in agreement with that, this is nothing more than a power grab by the Kremlin.
Matthew Schmidt is a professor of national security at the University of New Haven and a former professor of military operations planning at the U.S. Army School of Advanced Military Studies in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Here in Washington Monday, President Obama met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House. The agenda was broad, but focused mainly on the Mideast peace negotiations, about which Mr. Obama spoke to reporters.
They are tough negotiations. The issues are profound. Obviously, if they were easy, they would have been resolved many years ago. But I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu has approached these negotiations with a level of seriousness and commitment that reflects his leadership and the desire for the Israeli people for peace. It's my belief that ultimately it is still possible to create two states, a Jewish state of Israel and a state of Palestine, in which people are living side by side in peace and security. But it's difficult, and it requires compromise on all sides. And I just want to publicly again commend the Prime Minister for the seriousness with which he's taken these discussions.
Prime Minister Netanyahu said the Israeli people expect him to remain strong and hold out for the best possible deal. He said Israel is doing its part to pursue peace, but the Palestinians are not. Mr. Netanyahu also spoke about Israel's concerns over Iran's nuclear agenda.
The greatest challenge, undoubtedly, is to prevent Iran from acquiring the capacity to make nuclear weapons. I think that goal can be achieved if Iran is prevented from enriching uranium and dismantles fully its military and nuclear installations. Now, Mr. President, if that goal can be achieved peacefully and through diplomacy, I can tell you that no country has a greater stake in this than Israel.
Iran maintains its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes, but a number of Western nations, including the U.S., believe otherwise. China's top legislative body begins its annual meetings Wednesday in Beijing, where the promotion of a broad and ambitious reform agenda launched by President Xi Jinping late last year will be a top priority. The meeting will mark 1 year since Mr. Xi became China's top leader and comes amid a rapidly expanding corruption crackdown as the pace of the world's second largest economy slows. VOA's Bill Ide reports from Beijing.
China's National People's Congress is the world's largest parliament with some 3,000 delegates. At the opening ceremony Wednesday, Premier Li Keqiang will deliver a speech called the Government Work Report, a lengthy address that is typically packed with not only Communist Party slogans, but clues regarding the country's policy direction. Mr. Li will also announce the government's annual target for economic growth, which is widely expected to remain at 7.5%. However, with China's economy continuing to slow and growing concerns about massive local debt, some say China's leaders could lower it to 7%. China's economy has slowed dramatically in recent years from double-digit growth. The public has also become more vocal about environmental concerns and the country's policy of growth at any cost. Over the next 8.5 days, delegates at the meeting will be discussing some 68 bills, 11 of them focusing on the environment. Skies were clear Tuesday, but just recently Beijing's air pollution was hovering around severe levels for days. National People's Congress spokeswoman Fu Ying says environmental legislation will be a top issue during this year's meetings. Fu Ying says the problem of smog has become a symbolic and difficult issue in many cities in China, and increasingly more are being affected. But it is not just air pollution, she says. The problem of water and soil pollution is even more serious. Last fall, China's President Xi Jinping unveiled a package of reforms aimed at overhauling the economy and promoting more competition between private enterprises and state-owned monopolies, which dominate China's economy. The reforms also seek to promote rule of law and abolish long-standing policies that hinder the equal distribution of wealth in the country of 1.35 billion people. Fuying says it is the NPC's role to provide a legal backbone to the massive reform project Mr. Xi has initiated. She says that when it comes to major reforms of public concern, delegates should draft, revise, and abolish laws as needed to ensure that major reforms are carried out in accordance with the law. Huang Jing, professor of public policy at the National University of Singapore, says for now, it is up to China's parliament to approve the reform plan.
This is, could be especially interesting or even more difficult than previous years because the reform policies cut deep into the current political and economic structure, which means there will be a massive redistribution of power, privilege, and interests.
President Xi's reforms deliberately aim to break monopolies of what Huang calls the Iron Triangle, state-owned enterprises, the financial sector, and local governments. Mr. Xi has also taken steps, analysts say, to centralize his power. The president now heads three special committees, one on economic reform, another on security, and a third focusing on the internet. China's president has also been aggressively promoting a crackdown on corruption in the country, which analysts say can also help remove obstacles to reform. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
The murder trial of South African Olympic runner Osco Pistorius has attracted unprecedented media attention. But the coverage of the story has not been without problems. VOA's Anita Powell has details from Pretoria.
Oscar Pistorius' closely watched murder trial is the first major South African criminal trial to be broadcast live from within the courtroom. The trial is being played on local radio stations, and two South African news providers have started a cable channel dedicated entirely to the case. But critics say the media attention is not without its problems. Among the critics is the trial's judge, Thokozile Masipa. On day two of proceedings, Masipa lashed out at local media for publishing a photo of a witness who did not give broadcasters permission to film her testimony. In doing so, Masipa showed that while she may talk very softly, she carries a big stick.
I must say this is very disturbing. I am warning the media, if you do not behave, you are not going to be treated with soft gloves by this court.
University of the Witwatersrand journalism professor Anton Harbour said the media outlets, including a prominent TV news station that ran a photo of witness Michelle Berger on screen along with her testimony, made a mistake.
I think it was very foolish of the media to run a picture of the witness when it's clear the courts were trying to protect her. I think technically they may not have been in breach of the rules and regulations, but they were certainly in breach of the spirit. And that's a rather silly thing to do when the judge has her finger hovering over the control button for public broadcast.
Pistorius has pleaded not guilty to the charge of murdering his girlfriend Riva Steenkamp on Valentine's Day 2013. He says he mistook Steenkamp for an intruder when he shot her four times through a locked bathroom door. In its first 2 days, the state has tried to use the testimony of Pistorius's neighbors and circumstantial evidence to discredit his story. Each time, defense lawyer Barry Rue has methodically tried to pick apart the witnesses. But Harbour says this level of skill and detail is not typical.
Well, this is representative of the best in South African justice, when media scrutiny and lots of money means everyone's on their best behavior and have all the resources they need. But this is rich man's justice in a country where, in most cases, and cases of this sort are not unusual in South Africa, the defense would obviously, the accuser would often have no defense. The prosecutor would often be overworked and underprepared. And you never know about the behavior of the judge or the magistrate.
To see that, one need look no further than the Pretoria High Court. Court GD, where Pistorius is being tried, is a hive of media activities. Reporters madly type in the packed media seats. Photographers lurk outside the courtroom. Across the street, media organizations have erected a virtual tent camp. But just down the hall, a court has been listening for months to the wrenching tale of Zanele Khumalo. Hers is a common tale in South Africa, where a woman is killed every 8 hours by her intimate partner. Zanele was 18 and 5 months pregnant. Her 26-year-old boyfriend and father of that unborn child, Tato Kutumela, was found guilty in January of raping and murdering her in 2011. The case has dragged on for more than 2 years since then. On Thursday, Kutumela is due to be sentenced in the High Court. No one expects the case or the verdict to garner much attention. The eyes of the world will be looking just down the hall at Oscar Pistorius. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria, South Africa.
March 3rd was Africa Environment Day, and the UN used the occasion to show a link between desertification, climate change, and threats to security. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Desertification, despite how it sounds, is not just about deserts.
Desertification means land degradation in the drylands. Desertification can be caused by overcultivation, overgrazing, change of rainfall patterns, and many human activities. So it doesn't really mean the expansion of the desert, but it is a land degradation that is happening in dry land areas.
That's Yuki Hori, spokesperson for the Berlin-based UN Convention to Combat Desertification. She says land degradation is occurring more than ever.
In many developing countries, the needs of people living in poverty depend on the availability of land and natural resources. So if you ask people who are forced to migrate from villages in Ethiopia, Darfur, or Mali, you would hear them at one point saying that they had to leave their homeland because they could no longer sustain their living. This is the reality of desertification.
As more people are finding out, including those in the United States, climate change involves more than rising global temperatures.
Climate change brings more frequent occurrence of severe weather events like prolonged drought and flash floods. These events accelerate land degradation and ramp people away from home.
Hori says besides the link to climate change, desertification can directly affect both national and international security.
Not many people know that 80% of the major armed conflict that affected society occurred in vulnerable drylands ecosystems. So this new booklet, Desertification, the Invisible Frontline, makes the connection between land, governance, and security in an explicit way in order to increase the interest of all countries to invest in sustainable land management.
Conflict, she says, can break out over scarce natural resources or the loss of economic livelihoods. Sustainable land management means more efficient use of land and water, such as reducing water runoff and evaporation from unprotected soil, improving water storage, and upgrading irrigation. It also includes agroforestry, whereby trees are used to enhance agriculture, and more careful use of land needed for grazing. Hori says it's easy to make the connection between land degradation and economic and social welfare. That, she says, should encourage policymakers to act.
Expert warns that the current land degradation causes annual economic losses of $40 billion, for example. But on the other hand, sustainable land management practices could raise world crop supplies by an estimated 2.3 billion tons annually, which is about $1.4 trillion.
The UNCCD released its new booklet on Africa Environment Day. The African Union established it in 2002, but in 2012, the day was renamed Wangari Maathai Day in honor of the late Kenyan environmentalist and activist who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. Ceremonies marking the occasion were held in Maseru, Lesotho. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.